Hey there. Thanks for listening to Here and Now Anytime. If you like what you hear, we'd love if you subscribe to or followed the show in your favorite podcast app. Just look for Here and Now Anytime. And if you can leave a rating or review while you're at it, we would really appreciate it. It helps us a lot. And telling your friends about the show helps too. Thanks. Now, here's today's show.
My brother was assassinated in 2019. In 2020, my mother was assassinated. And just 4 months ago, my only brother left was also killed.
The controversial public health order, Title 42, is set to expire tonight. What does that mean for migrants seeking asylum at the border? It's Thursday, May 11th, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Kalyani Saxena. Today on the show, we'll hear about a new book detailing the dramatic effort to save North America's birds from extinction. And we'll get a sneak peek at Nintendo's most anticipated game of the year. But first, Title 42. The controversial public health order, which allowed the U.S. to quickly expel migrants, is set to expire tonight at midnight. The Biden administration has finalized a rule that would make it harder for many people to claim asylum at the U.S.-Mexico border. Officials say the goal is to discourage migrants from illegal border crossings and to create new legal pathways. But immigration advocates say they'll be challenging the rule in court. Deepa Fernandez spoke with an immigration advocate, who you'll hear from shortly. But first, let's hear from two migrants facing danger in their home countries and hoping to claim asylum in the U.S.
Just over the border from El Paso, Texas, it was a busy day at a migrant informational center in Ciudad Juarez. That was where, on a recent day, we first spoke with a woman, Mrs. Gonzalez. We're only using the last names of those we talked with because they fear for their safety. Gonzalez had just spent another frustrating morning trying to get an appointment using the government's CBP1 app. Migrants are required to use the app to book an appointment with U.S. officials to determine whether they can enter the U.S. Gonzalez, her husband and cousin are seeking asylum because she says they're afraid to return to their home in the central Mexican city of Guanajuato.
My tragedy began, unfortunately, in 2019. My brother was assassinated in 2019. In 2020, my mother was assassinated. And just 4 months ago, my only brother left was also killed.
Her mother witnessed her brother's killing and reported the murder to the police. The killer retaliated by coming after her mother and then her remaining brother. She told me she and her husband hid in their own home, only leaving when it was absolutely necessary.
My husband only went to work and back, but they found him at his work and beat him up. I didn't know what happened to him, and when I went to look for him, where he worked, everything was wide open, but he wasn't there. Then, the next day, as I was walking near our home, he arrived all beaten up.
Gonzalez said her husband was not just beaten up, he'd been tortured.
We have photos of how they left him. He had cigarette burns on his hands.
When men tried to kidnap her cousin, he managed to escape and hide in nearby mountains. Gonzalez doesn't know if it was a gang attack on her family or maybe the cartels. Last month, they headed for the United States to claim asylum, only to discover the closed border and frustration using an app to get an appointment with Border Patrol.
Every morning, we try to get an appointment on the app. Many times, when the appointment calendar comes up, it kicks me out. The furthest I've gotten is when you need to upload a photo or video, but then I can't go any further.
It's been a trying month. The family was in a shelter, but left after Gonzalez experienced a severe allergic reaction from bedbugs. Now they're spending their last pesos on a hotel room and praying for the app to work so they can present their case legally to U.S. authorities. As we talked to the Gonzalez family, another young man, Mr. Giron, came to the information center. I asked him why he left Honduras.
¿Me puede decir por qué salió de Honduras?
Because I was being forced to pay extortion money, and they killed my brother in 2020.
When I asked him who did all of this, if it was gangs, he said simply,
Dos pandillas.
He's been in Ciudad Juarez for 3 years, waiting, trying to cross into the U.S. legally. He thought the app would finally help him make an appointment to see Border Patrol, but it hasn't.
I have the app, but I don't know how to read or write, so I cannot use the app.
Those are the stories of two migrants who are in Ciudad Juarez. Also in Ciudad Juarez is Jennifer Babay. She directs legal services at Las Americas Immigrant Advocacy Center, and she joins us now. Jen, in your experience, how common are these stories that we just heard from Mrs. Gonzalez and Mr. Giron?
Unfortunately, these stories are incredibly common. I would say to speak to anyone who's been staying in Juarez, whether for a month or for several years, who's been seeking entry into the U.S. for asylum, it's the exception rather than the rule for them not to have experienced kidnapping, to have experienced having family members killed, and to then experience issues in Juarez.
And there are many people waiting there in Juarez. What are you seeing today on the ground, this day that Title 42 will expire?
There's a mix of desperation and an expectation that after today, individuals who have been waiting for months or years will be able to enter. And so the role of legal providers such as our organization is trying to disseminate accurate information about what's actually going to take place and how difficult it will continue to be to be able to access our asylum system.
So let's talk about actually what's going to happen, because there's this new rule from the Biden administration, which advocates have dubbed the, quote, asylum ban, and that's going to go into effect at 11:59 p.m. when Title 42 expires. And it's going to apply to everyone now at the border and those coming who don't have a visa to enter but want to make a claim of asylum. Jen, I understand there are three ways in under this new rule. The rule describes it as three exemptions. Can you explain those?
Yes. So first and foremost, the rule is prioritizing and seeking to emphasize that individuals enter with a mobile app called CBP-1. And so if you enter and wait for an appointment that way and cross at a port of entry, then you would be exempt from this rule. The second means, of course, is if you can show that you applied for asylum in another country on the way to the U.S. and you were denied. And there's a myriad of issues with that. And then final and foremost is humanitarian parole, which is only available for a very, very small number of nationalities and requires its own expectations and qualifications before you can enter.
And that's the one we've been hearing about Venezuelans, Cubans, I think. You have to apply from your own country and then you fly in to the U.S., right?
That's correct. And not only that, you must be able to afford the airfare. It's the only way you'd be allowed to enter. And you must have a sponsor already in the U.S. who is the one who actually submits the paperwork on your behalf to say that you can enter with this temporary protection.
So to the first two exemptions you mentioned, Jen, I have to say what's really confusing to me is that this third country rule forces any non-Mexican to claim asylum in the country they pass through and be rejected. But if they don't do this, they can still show up at the border and try to get one of the limited appointments available on the CBP-1 app that you mentioned. So you actually don't need to claim asylum in Guatemala or Honduras or a country that you pass through, but you'll just be stuck waiting at the border until you get an appointment. Am I understanding that correctly?
That's exactly right. And the reason advocates such as myself are calling this a ban and are referring to it as such a serious obstacle is that the obstacles and conditions to asylum have absolutely nothing to do with the merits of someone's claim. So never mind what they've experienced, the reason they fled, solely based on whether they had access to a telephone app and were able to use it in enough time before something else happened to them in Mexico, they could be completely rejected from the U.S. and not just denied asylum, they would have a 5-year ban from ever reentering the United States.
Because then they would be ejected under what's called Title 8 that we've talked about here on the program, which leads to that 5-year ban. How do you think this is going to impact people at the border right now, like Mrs. Gonzalez or Mr. Giron? Mrs. Gonzalez is Mexican, so third country rule wouldn't apply to her. But Mr. Giron is from Honduras.
I think for both of them, this is going to still increase the desperation and require them to continue to find resources to wait if they continue to try to attempt to access CBP-1. If the app doesn't work, if an appointment is not available, then the only recourse left to them to find safety is the route many take out of desperation, which is to enter some other way.
And we should point out, we've heard there are about 1,000 appointments available on the app each day. There are tens of thousands of people in just one city, let alone many of the border cities, waiting. Does that sound right to you?
Yes, unfortunately, those 1,000 spots are spread border-wide, so every port of entry must divide those numbers each day.
What do you think is going to happen, Jen?
It's tough to say, but for us, for advocates such as myself, we're expecting to see a lot of the same humanitarian issues we saw under Title 42. We're expecting to need to find ways to disseminate legal information quickly in situations such as shelters and so on. We're also expecting to see family separation, which has been a big issue since Title 42 was enacted. And these are all concerns and issues that we're trying to prepare for.
Jennifer Babai directs legal services at Las Americas Immigrant Advocacy Center. Jen, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, billions of birds have vanished from North America over the past 50 years. A new book documents scientists' dramatic efforts to save species from extinction. Robin Young speaks with the authors after the break.
It's nature's symphony, but it could be silenced. All those birds, the Florida grasshopper sparrow, eastern meadowlark, Florida scrub jay, Sirculian warbler, and northern spotted owl are being saved by human intervention. Remember that shocking 2019 survey? Nearly 3 billion birds, a third of the birds in North America, had disappeared since 1970. Climate change, habitat lost to plowed farms and development, cats. There are ways to help. Did you know you can buy bird-friendly coffee from farmers convinced to bring back trees on coffee plantations? How about birders paying a small fee on bird feed to go towards conservation? Anders and Beverly Gyllenhaal are here. Yes, they are aunt and uncle to the actors, but more important, they're journalists who traveled the country for a year in an Airstream. Their book is A Wing and a Prayer, The Race to Save Our Vanishing Birds. Anders and Beverly, welcome.
Hi, Robin.
Hi. Thanks so much for having us.
Oh, well, thank you so much for this book. Let's jump right in with a bird, the Florida grasshopper sparrow, only found, you tell us, in three small clusters in Florida around Disney World. And in one cluster, it went from hundreds of the bird to just 13 almost overnight. One scientist told you, Anders, we're in the emergency room. This is fast.
Right. They simply collapsed from a number of factors. And now scientists are trying to rebuild the population, and they do it sort of like helicopter parents watching over their every move, breeding them in captivity, putting them back out onto the grasslands, and then watching them try to build the population. And it is working. They're slowly bringing this bird back.
Well, and the reason they have to help them is one researcher called these little birds prairie potato chips. You know, they would just be a snack for other species. And by the way, we'll hook you up at hereandnow.org with the Gyllenhaal's website where you can find these projects like the White Oak Project there in Florida. But Beverly, these stories are repeated over and over. There's a woman who dresses like a whooping crane, complete with a puppet crane on her hand, to work with birds. There's the Hoy family in Kansas, proving you can raise cattle and keep the grasslands for birds. You met people like Mike Parr at the American Bird Conservancy and David Noggle at the University of Montana, who point out, we have the facts. We know birds are disappearing. What's standing in the way of preventing that?
Well, you know, one of the problems, of course, is that habitat has gradually disappeared as the country has developed more and more. But what we're finding now is that with some particular types of approaches, we can actually coexist with birds. And you mentioned the Hoy family on their ranch in Kansas. They're finding out that what's good for the birds is actually really good for the cows too. And they did this by putting an emphasis on all of the native grasses and native plants. They pulled out all the plants and trees that didn't belong on these ranch lands. And once they got the habitat basically bird friendly, they came back.
And this is the answer to the question of why should I care? And that is that birds play this central role. They are the nature's workhorses. They pollinate, they spread seeds, they clean up the refuse of nature, and they fertilize the land and the seas. They're this crucial component in making nature work. And for many years, we didn't really pay that much attention. We could take birds for granted. Until now, we realize that's no longer the case. And so we have to stop and say, can we coexist? And the answers in this book are telling us that we can if we'll do a few things that make sense for both birds and for people.
Yeah. Beverly, you both write about things we've learned along the way. There were the timber wars in the 1990s. The logging industry in Washington State pitted against the northern spotted owl. Logging limited in order to protect those birds. People angry, environmentalists vilified. But environmentalists also, and people who love birds, also learned. What did they learn?
Well, you know, one of the things they learned is that we don't have to go as far as the timber wars. The cousin to the northern spotted owl is the California spotted owl. And so in California, they said, you know, it just doesn't have to be this way. So one of the things they needed to do was figure out where all of these owls were in this vast Sierra Nevada, millions and millions of acres, mountain range. So what they've done is they've put these recorders, strapped them all to different trees around, and then they listen to the hoots using these algorithms from artificial intelligence to figure out where the birds are.
It's a profound new development, one of the many technologies that basically give us a window into the world of birds that we've never had before.
Talk about more of these technologies. There's, you know, putting little devices directly onto the birds.
The best example of that was the cerulean warbler, this little blue bird that travels the length of the hemisphere, 12 or 14 countries by the time it goes from one end of the hemisphere to the other. And if you track that bird, you can figure out where it lands, where it might be running into trouble. Then you can begin to figure out what can be done on the ground to save that. One scientist told us, you know, you can't do much for birds if you don't know where they are.
Well, talk about Hawaii and an effort to breed mosquitoes that would then mate with mosquitoes in Hawaii to eliminate a malaria that the mosquitoes were infecting the birds with.
Hawaii is the sort of dystopian future that we're trying to avoid. A third of the forest birds are gone from Hawaii. And in this case, climate change is just warming the temperatures, allowing mosquitoes to reach birds that they couldn't otherwise reach. So they're going to spread a kind of laboratory bred mosquito across the forest that will then mate with wild mosquitoes and act as a kind of birth control and hopefully stop the spread of this disease that's killing the birds.
What this 3 billion bird, one big number, showed us was the fact that, you know, over half the species in North America are in decline. We've got an avalanche of birds in need that are spiraling their way toward the endangered species list. But that's not where we really want to be working. We want to be working farther back upstream with birds that still have a chance, where the methods that they're using aren't quite as complicated as lab-bred mosquitoes, and where we can make a difference, and where it's also not as costly as some of these on-the-edge remedies.
Boy, there's so many of them. People are attempting to clone birds to bring them back from extinction. The carrier pigeon, that's another project. A project in California, it's a nonprofit called Revive and Restore, where they're freezing cells from endangered species in what they call the frozen zoo, you know, maybe bring them back in the future. But again, you talked about the things that birds do, Anders, and you mentioned in your list in the book, it's also our mental health. There's something so, I mean, it's the reason that you say we name our cars after birds, we name our high school teams after the Eagles. You know, Emily Dickinson wrote the poem, "Hope is the Thing with Feathers."
You know, that may be the most important thing that we can emphasize, is that birds speak to us in ways that nothing else does. And they are constantly speaking. They're everywhere. They sing to us. So there is a connection between people and birds that we hope will help save them if we're paying attention. It's not just the services they provide in the biological sense. It's also the beauty, the soundtrack that they provide.
Yeah. What can people do? You have a terrific list. Keep your cats inside. Don't let dogs run on the beach if they chase and kill birds. But this idea of maybe birders paying a tax, the way waterfowl hunters always have, and they pride themselves on being conservationists. How would that work?
Sure. It's pretty simple. If you look at ducks and geese from the 1930s on, they have developed a conservation empire, in effect, that raises money through taxes on ammunition, bows and arrows, et cetera, and that helps to fund conservation. You could easily put taxes on binoculars, birdseed. $4 billion in birdseed is sold every year. So there's plenty of care for the 50 million bird watchers. If we would pay a little bit, this could help fund conservation efforts for the birds that aren't getting attention right now.
There are people who will be willing, but we're also going to direct you to all these incredible nonprofits doing this kind of conservation work. And projects like the Cornell Labs eBird or Project Feeder Watch. What's eBird and how can people get involved in that? And why, outside of their own enjoyment?
eBird is essentially a phone app. As you're walking around your yard, wherever you are, you just tap in the birds that you hear or see, and then you can submit your list to the Cornell Lab, and 700,000 people around the world are doing this. The lab is able to take all of these sightings, and what ends up happening is all of a sudden they know where birds are healthy and they know where they're in trouble. And we're helping to fuel that science.
There's so much more. It's both heartbreaking and inspiring. The book is A Wing and a Prayer, The Race to Save Our Vanishing Birds. Again, we'll hook you up to everything at herenow.org. Anders and Beverly Gyllenhaal, thank you so much.
Thanks so much,
thank
Robin.
You. Thank you very much, Robin.
Great to talk with you.
Coming up, we've got a little treat for all the video game fans. Tomorrow, The Legend of Zelda, Tears of the Kingdom, arrives for the Nintendo Switch. It's a highly anticipated game, and we'll hear from one of the few people who's played it. Deepa speaks with Jean Park, video games reporter for The Washington Post. Stick around.
Nintendo's biggest game of the year, The Legend of Zelda, Tears of the Kingdom, is out tomorrow.
Link, you are our final hope.
The blockbuster release comes just a month after the Super Mario Bros. Movie smashed box office records.
Bowser is coming.
I'm not afraid. I'll do anything for my brother.
We're going to save him.
So for the latest on Nintendo's banner year, we're joined by Gene Park, video games reporter for The Washington Post, and he's one of the lucky few to have played the newest Zelda title. He's joining us from NPR Studios in DC. Hi, Gene.
Hi, Deepa. Thanks so much for having me here.
So, Gene, I'm not a gamer, but I do have them in my household, and of course I've heard about Zelda. Tell me what's so special about these games.
The Legend of Zelda has often been considered by many people as kind of the flagship series of the medium. In particular, the 1996 title, The Legend of Zelda Ocarina of Time, has often been referred to as the Citizen Kane of video games, in particular how it defined the mechanics of navigating 3D space.
And it's also kind of you get dropped into the middle of a really beautiful world, I'm told, and then you get to navigate it.
Exactly. The 2017 prequel to Tears of the Kingdom was revolutionary in how it redefined what open-world games look like and the kind of freedom that you can have in it.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of experimental, right? Physics-driven in a way?
Absolutely. It's very physics-driven, and it kind of speaks to its broad appeal. It's very easy to understand. When I was playing Tears of the Kingdom, my girlfriend actually helped me with several puzzles, and she's not a gamer herself, but she understood the physics of and mechanics of what's going on. And she totally helped me solve several puzzles. It was great.
I love it. Okay, so expectations are high for Tears of the Kingdom. And it's bringing back beloved characters, including an old villain. Let's listen.
Do not look away. You witness a king's revival and the birth of his new world.
Okay, that's Ganondorf. Now, you reviewed the latest Zelda game for the Washington Post. Has Nintendo done it again?
Absolutely. Anyone who enjoyed the game Breath of the Wild is going to absolutely love this one. They address any issues that people might have had with the first game, including how filled out the adventures are, and especially the story. Part of the big mystery of this game is, you know, why is Ganondorf back? It's been 15 years since he's been in the narrative.
Okay. Now, what I'm really fascinated by is you playing the game. You kind of came to some creative solutions. Tell me what you got up to in the game.
Yeah, the main premise of the game is that Link, the hero, is able to build his own solutions. So he's able to kind of engineer. If you need a car to get across the world, you can just build yourself a car. Hmm. There was many times where I needed to get across an endless pit, so I built myself a little roller coaster to go across.
It.
So it's very simple to understand, and it's very rewarding, and it encourages different methods of play. So the way I might have solved puzzles is way different than someone else might.
Okay. Well, I want to ask you, because it sounds fun, but it also sounds complicated. Is Tears of the Kingdom a tricky game to play?
It is pretty tricky, and it's actually pretty difficult. But the interesting thing about it is that, you know, as long as you have a rudimentary understanding of physics and chemistry, you know, fire melts ice, that kind of thing, I think it's the kind of thing that anyone is able to grasp, as long as you have some familiarity with video games.
Okay. Now, fans love the freedom of 2017's Breath of the Wild. Even if it had a really spare story with very little dialogue, has that changed in this sequel?
Absolutely. I think people are going to really be amazed at how much, there's so many side adventures. I didn't even finish even a quarter of them. And so many of those stories actually weave into the main narrative. And there's even a quest where Link becomes a print journalist. There's a whole newspaper company there, and you get hired as a journalist. And part of your assignment is to find Princess Zelda.
Well, that might be modeled after you there, Gene. Well, we're talking about Nintendo in 2023 being hugely successful. Is this a new era for the company where they're not just a gaming company, but more of a global kind of multimedia giant? I'm thinking movies, theme parks.
That's right, Deepa. Nintendo has a very sound strategy in appealing to multi-generational people. So the Mario movie, you would see kids enjoying it, but then you would see parents, 40-year-olds like me, who would kind of weep and, you know, get those nostalgic feelings. So Nintendo has opened a theme park in Universal Studios. The Mario movie has made well over $1 billion by now. So I think it's safe to say that Nintendo is kind of slowly approaching a Disney level in terms of, you know, being a multimedia company that's also kind of a lifestyle company too.
All right. Gene Park, Washington Post reporter covering video games and gaming culture. Thank you so much, Gene.
Thank you, Deepa.
This podcast comes from the team behind Here and Now, from NPR and WBUR Boston. Today's stories were produced by Ashley Locke, Julia Corcoran, and James Perkins Mastromarino. Todd Munt, Gabe Bullard, Kat Welch, and Peter O'Dowd edited today's show. Technical direction from Max Liebman and Patrick O'Connor. Theme music by Max, Mike Moschetto, and Chris Bentley. Our digital producers are Grace Griffin and Allison Hagen. And the executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.